Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to session 162, Fetishizing the Family, the Effect of Symbolic System of Family within LDS Wards. Please turn off your cell phones, you know this. Also, go check out the book sales sometime during the symposium, because some of the proceeds go help Sunstone, so that would be great. All right, our first presenter will be Christine Black. She is a PhD candidate in Sociology of Religion at Drew University. She is currently in the writing phase of a dissertation titled Mormon Kinship, the Symbolic System of Family Within Mormon Religious Communities. This work has also been accepted for forthcoming publication by Edwin Mellon Press. She teaches philosophy courses at Utah Valley University as an adjunct and serves on UVU's Peace and Justice Studies Executive Committee. She holds a master's degree from Drew University in Sociology of Religion and a bachelor's degree from University of Montana in Philosophy with a minor in Women's Studies. And then the respondent will be Chelsea Shields Strayer, who is an anthropology PhD candidate at Boston University and recently moved to Utah. She is a president of Mormons for ERA, a founding member of LDS Wave, a blogger and exponent magazine, Mormon Matters, and other Mormon feminist organizations.
Thank you. I'm so glad that someone came. This is, writing and research can be such a solitary practice that it's really nice to get out and see real people, and I'm really hoping for some feedback, so thank you so much for coming, and I look forward to your questions and comments. After having taught, I realized that people learn and obtain information in various different ways, so I'm presenting you three different ways that you can get the information today. I've made a QR code of my paper. You can zap it and download it, so you can take the paper home with you. There's the PowerPoint. I'm not going to read the slides. You're on your own. So that's one way of looking at it. You know, you can get it visually. You can hear the paper. All three of these are a little bit different. So if you want to look at all three of them, it's a way to get a more robust idea of my research. Also, if you would want to ask me questions or make further comments that we don't have time for, feel free to contact me at kblack@drew.edu. And I would be happy to hear from you. Okay, so let me first just say, our moderator has introduced this as a bigger project. So it was hard to kind of reduce it down to something really small, but this gives you a little bit of a snapshot. So it's not everything that I'm doing, but it gives you a little bit of a taste of what I'm doing. In my larger project, I argue that despite the possible divisive properties inherent with the focus of family, active Mormons, and I define active Mormons as people who are currently attending church on a regular basis, and who self-identify as Mormon, tend to be able to successfully derive meaning from that focus, which aids them in developing an ethic of care towards others. And the title of my topic here today, Fetishizing the Family, let me just stop and define the term fetishize. I'm taking a Marxian approach, which is, he did an approach that he thought about the value we add to objects. And he called this the fetishization of commodities. And it's a value that we add to something, forget that we've added that, and then mistakenly believe that the object that we've added the value to has the value as an inherent property. So this is kind of the context that I'm coming from when I say fetishizing. Okay, so the first question that I asked when I first started talking to Mormons, a little bit of self-disclosure, I left the church in the 80s, grew up in Utah, officially left the church. It was an arduous project back then. It took a little bit of time in doing. Vowed never to come back to either Mormonism or Utah. Yet here I am. So I think some distance geographically religiously, theologically, gave me the opportunity to look at Mormonism again with new eyes. And being at a Methodist theological school kind of gave me a different lens to look at things and to take a critical approach to religion in ways that I hadn't before. And it let me consider Mormonism from a sociological standpoint. So I look at the social construction of meaning rather than the theological construction. So when I first started talking to Mormons about their congregations and how they lived their religion, they would keep telling me about their ward family. And they would use this term a lot. A lot of people would. And I wondered, you know, why? What does that mean? What do Mormons mean when they say ward family? As I started my research and starting to look at this idea of family, I was very well aware that the church had family as a focus. And I didn't realize, however, that it was a fairly new focus. And it's evolved quite a bit since the 1960s. Currently, 3 out of every 4 General Conference talks has family as its main topic. But that wasn't always the case. As also, going back and reminding you that I'm a social scientist, I look at the connections between what's going on in society, what goes on with the church, either how they're pushing back, how they're taking things in stride, and what's happening to their idea, how they're constructing meaning around ideas based on what's going on in the greater community. So here there's just a brief thumbnail of what's going on, especially since the correlation movement in the 1960s. And it was at that time that family became the focus, and it shifted from priesthood. Then, of course, in the, when was it? I've lost my date here. We were told that intellectualism, so-called intellectualism, the feminist rights movement, and the gay rights movement were some of the dangers to church. I think the race issue was also part of this, and it wasn't really addressed directly. The church received a lot of pushback from that. And when the Civil Rights Act came about in 1964, it raised awareness about how the church discriminated against men of color. And at the time, at Brigham Young University would be harassed, games would be picketed, other athletic clubs would refuse to play them. And it became more of a topic in counterculture than in the main conversations. So I found it really interesting that he excluded race from that comment. Also in the 60s, it was the birth of the second wave feminist movement. More women had been going to work. And in 1963, we had the Equal Pay Act. And I believe that this caused a lot of religious communities to dig their heels in more determinedly into strict gender roles. Mormons aren't the only ones who did this. So a lot of conservative religious groups had this idea of Victorian imagery. Anyway, so there was a woman with the table. We were told in society in general that women could be a little bit more. We could go out and work. Especially in the 1940s, women had to work. But the church, in the beginning of the 1940s, women started being told to restrict their activities to homemaking. And women were told that they should gain approval from both God and their husbands if they wanted to work. So this overlooked the fact that women had to work. Some women didn't have a choice. And it also left single women who work outside of the conversation. And I think that's still part of an issue. I think it's been mentioned a couple of times that that's one of the glass ceilings within the church. And something that's not really talked about is how single people are excluded from the bigger conversations. I think it's changing, but I think there's still a lot of ways that single men and women get left out of the conversation. So in 1995, come back up here, Proclamation Family, proclamation to the world, which I refer to as the proclamation, was issued, and it gave near scriptural basis for sexual division of labor. And it gave the role of women and mothers, women as mothers, men as priesthood holders, and left no room to talk about men as fathers, women as leaders of their family. It also set up a heteronormative model of family, which left no other model of family open to consideration. And it put women's bodies into direct relationship with Mormon's soteriology. Temple ritual is one of the things that really underscore this. So it really anchors the family in different ways, in theology, in society, in the home. And a lot of people find this really divisive and hard to live with. And it's not an idea of family that makes them, gives them all the, you know, the warm fuzzies that, I think it's Harold B. Lee that developed that warm fuzzy program. Do you know what I'm talking, anyway. Okay, so I wondered, with all of these divisive things going on, what happens? How do people reconcile this difference? We all are familiar with the church's slogan, family can be together forever. I found when I've been doing my interviews, some women say, that's not good news. And, you know, what happens if I'm good? And while there is some humor in that, there's also a really serious side. Mormon women suffer from domestic violence, as often or perhaps even more, due to strict patriarchy rules, as other women in society. Sociologist Nancy Nason Clark suggests that the religious women whose beliefs are enforced by an ideology that sees women's roles as wife and mother may find it even harder to leave an abusive marriage and may suffer more because of that. So telling women who are victims of domestic violence that they're going to be with their abuser forever is more of a promise of hell rather than heaven. So one of the things that I ended up doing when I have all these ideas in my head, like, okay, so, you know, there's this domestic violence issue, there's people being left out of the conversation, there's forms of family that aren't being recognized. How do we get this all together? So I developed a symbolic system of family. And it contains, it's, if you picture a child's wooden puzzle and you see how the pieces fit together, they can be an individual piece and the child can play with that one piece. They can put together in all kinds of patterns. This is one pattern that I think the idea of family can fit into. So at the top we have family units, which is actual families. We have society, which is some of the elements that I talked about before, things that are going on in the broader atmosphere. In the center is care. Talk about that later. And on the right-hand side is the LDS Church. And I think each of these have really important elements by themselves, but they all work together really well. And you'll notice that care kind of supports and undergirds family units there. So here's just a little bit bigger picture. I wasn't sure how that would come out. So it's talking about family structures. There's a lot of pieces, a lot of other little bits that go into this family idea. And not surprisingly, I found that Mormons' experiences of their actual family units really influences the way they think about family. I found that Mormons are more likely to be married than members of any other religious group, but they are just as likely to get divorced. In fact, divorce rates are probably a little bit more likely in the first 1 to 3 years. Despite the reality of divorce in single-parent families, Mormons hold fast to the idea of a 1950s model of family. And this is what family historian Stephanie Kuntz refers to as the nostalgia trap. The church still strongly endorses this strict gender role inherent in the model, and women are more likely women are more likely to be stay-at-home moms than any other women, group of American women. The LDS Church rhetoric not only fuels that nostalgic vision of family, but also promises followers that it can be its reality, even though that's not statistically so. I had to wonder if that has something to do with the high depression rates in Utah. I also think we all kind of have this idea of this model. I don't know of any young mother who looks at her little toddler and says, oh, you grow up so fast. Before you know it, you'll be twice divorced with children of your own, and I'll be living with a man I haven't even met yet. You just don't think that way. We still have this cultural idea that this is the goal. But what I found out was that when this wasn't the reality, people developed their own kinship networks. First of all, kinship networks of their own. So one woman went with her husband to visit their in-laws, and her aunt has over 20 children. All but five of them are adopted. But they meet together really frequently. They get together for family dinners. And when this kind of family, extended family, isn't available, I found that Mormons make their own surrogate families. And one BYU single, attending singles ward down in Provo, told me that a lot of them are away from their families, so they make their own little families. And he says, we get to do crazy, cool stuff. So they do a lot of sharing like families would. Underpinning a lot of this idea of family is the assumption that there's an element of care. And I think it's reflected really good, although Mormons didn't use this line exactly, a lot of people I talked to gave me the impression that, well, home is someplace that I know that when I have to go there, they have to take me in. There will be people there to help me. Despite our differences, despite the fact that I've been away for a while, they're going to have to take care of me. So it's this expected element of care, but it's not entirely based on hopes. There's an actual element of care. There's this idea that people will love you and care for you. And in all the conversations that I had, there were some people who said, I know that my family doesn't provide that for me, but in some ways I think my community does. And then, of course, there was many of them who said, I know my Heavenly Father loves me. So this idea of family just started to explode. Started with the individual, went to a family unit, went to extended kinship networks, went to a bigger community, surrogate families, and then to God. It was like nesting dolls, one within another, and it just kept getting bigger and bigger. Mormons, of course, are not the only group to do this. So part of the really exciting part of my research is that nothing is really exciting. Mormons are like any other religious group. They believe in a deity that loves them. They believe in family that is supportive and caring. They have strong bonds with their communities. They have emotive bonds that keep them together. But I wondered, so what is the unique part? And of course, that led me to temples and doing work for ancestors. So for Mormons, taking care of kinship networks extends beyond the temporal and into generations of ancestors. I took this converting ancestors as really kind of a radical Christian idea. A lot of other Christian groups proselytize and baptize and save people. Mormons are the only group that I know of that does this for ancestors and people that they don't even know, people that have passed on. One of the interesting things is that this is how it's tied to the church and to family. I think this is, I'm going to point out a couple of points where they tie together, where these two triangles come together. And the temple is really, I think, the most obvious one that ties these two together. The eldest doctrine says that only those who have marriage performed in a Mormon temple are candidates for the greatest rewards in the hereafter. Although statistics don't show that Mormons really live that to the full extent that they're taught that. A lot of the ones that I talk to, did you have a comment?
What would that mean? I'm not understanding.
So the statistics here show that in Utah, a lot of people get married in the temple. Outside of Utah, fewer and fewer, so as few as 2% in South America are getting married in the temple. Now, that could be happening for a couple of reasons. Either they don't have access to a temple, they don't have the money to attend a temple. But it caught my attention that the church said that in order to reach the highest degree of heaven, you had to be married in a temple. I would have suspected this number to be much higher. So that's why I say the statistics don't really reflect that. But that doesn't really stop people from talking about the importance of temple, from wanting temple work done for themselves and their ancestors. I've heard people joke about, well, I'm not really sure about it now, and that's okay because I know that after I die, someone was going to do my work for me. And it's so if I'm wrong, then my base is recovered. So I think this idea is still something that really informs the way they think about family, whether they go through the temple or not. The more subtle element within the LDS Church that I found, though, was callings. And this is actually a doctrinal aspect as well. I asked interviewees how they participated in the ward, and most of them told me that they participated through their ward callings. So again, no big surprise. No big surprise that people find that their identities develop through their callings, that they find it personally rewarding. One woman told me that she was widowed at a fairly early age, and the group that she was put in charge of, it was a special interest group, helped get her out of the house, helped get her back into society again, helped her feel like she belonged. That happens in a lot of other groups. But what might not happen is why people do that. So I'll get to that in just a minute. One of the really surprising stories came from a woman who told me about how she helped some school children in Turkey get school supplies. Wasn't part of her calling, but she knew someone through the ward, and she helped them get supplies that they needed. And she said, well, it's kind of my way of serving a mission. And she said, I just feel like it's my duty as a Mormon to help where I can. So she took this idea of calling to a different level. And this is the level that I call an ethic of care. This is where ethic of care is developed. This is not my, ethic of care is not my naming. Carol Gilligan is the one that came up with this idea. She's actually an ethicist. And she said that an ethic of care is a normative theory of moral philosophy that establishes a standard of conduct deemed to be right or ethical, which is contextual. Decisions about moral dilemma favors relationships and emotions over deductive reasoning. And this is what I see Mormons doing. I even had one man tell me, you know, I really don't even like the people in my ward, but I love them. Took me a while to unravel that one. And I heard on a couple of occasions, people would say, like, oh, it's just so hard to go out and do this. But really, it's more for me. I do it for me rather than the people. I'm helping myself because it makes me feel good. So again, this is another part of moral ethicism, is that when you help others, you help yourself. And it's part of this ethic of care. Part of the important part of this theory, I think, is the assumption that these kind of nurturing traits are inherent and that they're more predominant in women. It doesn't mean that when men can't have them. It just means that women are more naturally inclined to exhibit and act on them. I think, it's my theory, that Mormonism teaches an ethic of care, that it enables us, it forces you almost to care for others. So it's like the man said, you know, I don't really like the people I go to church with, but I love them and I care for them anyway. So when the three meet together here on the bottom, care, society, and the LDS Church, I think service is the point that draws them all together. Serving others outside of one's home, serving each other inside the home, and being a good citizen are all elements of this. I was really shocked at how often I would get marriage advice. Shocked might not be the right word. But after listening to hours and hours of tapes and doing transcript work, I realized what they were telling me was how to be a good husband, a good wife, as a good partner, as well as how to be a good parent. And included in that was how to be a good son or daughter of God. So this idea of relationships really becomes cemented in ways in service that I think is unique to Mormonism. So then we move to society. We've moved to the left here. Social instances of family. So this kind of goes back to the 1960s thing that we had before, that it started with different ideas going on in society, how it went through Civil Rights Act, things like that. Social instances of family is ideas in the general society about family. One of the main ideas is that the family is under attack. Now, this doesn't mean that ninjas are breaking into homes and bludgeoning the members, but the threat is seen as just as real and just as much of a threat, just as much of a danger to the people inside the home. And these kind of threats are modernization, secularization, and different ideas about marriage and family. Such threats usually provoke some kind of action. And the LDS Church has definitely taken some action toward these things. Prop 8 is still fresh in a lot of our minds. When the Defense of Marriage Act was overturned really recently, the church issued another statement saying, regardless of the court decision, the church remains irrevocably committed to strengthening traditional marriage between a man and a woman, which for thousands of years has proven the best environment for nurturing children. As a sociologist, I have several issues with that phrase. First of all, thousands of years. Marriage between one man and one woman has not been around for thousands of years. And you could just as easily say that marriage between a man and a woman and a family, the nuclear family, is the best environment for abusing children as it is for nurturing children. Sociologist Penny Edgell's work is one that I find really fascinating. And she looks at this connection between society and family and church. And she talks about how they are both dependent upon each other. And this is what I found, that this idea of family kind of is recursive and it comes back into the church through the members. And the members think about family in different and new ways now than they did 40, 50 years ago. Now when I asked people what family meant to them, they said, well, it's people that I love and people who love me. People who accept me unconditionally. People that I'm not necessarily related to. People that I might not be blood kin with. But it's people who I believe are family, who treat me like family. Of course, there's the old joke about the nanny who gets hired by a family. And they take her in and they give her a room and they feed her and expect her to take care of the children and everything. And after a few months, she quits. And the mother goes to her and says, I can't believe it. Why are you quitting? We've treated you so well. We've treated you like one of the family. And then she says, ah, you admit it. So sometimes family is not necessarily who we're related to, but how we're treated. And we really want this idea of being accepted, non-judgmental acceptance, radical acceptance even. And this idea of radical love for each other in the community and even outside of the community. So churches send messages about what families should be through their rhetoric and programs. And on a larger view, not just Mormons, but all religions, congregants send messages about church programs, which ones are relevant through their attendance or non-attendance. For Mormons, I believe the pattern of conduct that speaks most loudly about who they are and what they believe is the patterns of things like observing the word of wisdom, attending church, filling callings, and practicing an ethic of care toward each other. And I see this, Mormons Building Bridges is one of an example of this. That even when people don't have don't share the same ideas. They might say, I don't really agree with, I still think the idea of families, one man, one woman, but I can still love you. When Mormons Building Bridges first marched in the Salt Lake City Parade last year, a Deseret News reporter said that one woman held up a sign that said, I can be a Mormon and still love and support my gay son. So this idea that you had to be either or, I think it's getting better, but it's still, I think what Dr. Ryan talked to us about last night is still part of the issue. While the march wasn't sponsored by the church in any way, the church did state that protecting marriage between a man and a woman does not affect church members' Christian obligation of love and kindness and humanity toward all people. And I see radical cases where this can happen. I've been attending a ward in Midvale. It's a really unique ward, and I see women come to church in jeans a lot of time. They'll have a smoke in the parking lot before they come in, and they will get up and bear their testimony, and people will hug them and say how brave they are for being authentically themselves. A woman in Relief Society class talked about working at the strip club and how she came to a revelation about loving your neighbor and accepting them meant accepting herself and accepting herself in the situation that she had to be in, that she felt like there was really no other way for her to make money. So I see that there's some changes about ideas and willingness to be more open and more vulnerable. And this is part of caring, an ethic of care, caring for yourself as well as caring for others in your family and in your community. So care, I put at the core of my model, because I think it really, everything relates to that in some way. And of course you can see here with my other elements that there's a lot more to care than what I have time to cover here. So what I see is, even though Mormons are accused of not being Christian because of their beliefs in a Trinitarian, a Trinity that is different, it's an actual Trinitarian deity rather than a three-in-one type of God, and that two of those deities have actual bodies, people will say they're not Christian. But I see that, first of all, they claim to be, they self-identify as Christian. I think you really have to take that and you have to give them that. I also see that they have a Christ-like love for others. And their humanitarian efforts really kind of show this. Other religious groups and other nonprofit groups do humanitarian efforts, but I believe that Mormons take this to a higher level. They feel that it's a responsibility to take care of everyone, and they've developed really robust programs, the welfare program and Welfare Square. In this sense, the biblical injunction to love your neighbor as yourself is taken to heart and into a peculiar lifestyle of being Mormon and being Christian. And part of this being Christian, being Mormon, is worshiping in small wards. Again, this is not unusual. A lot of religious groups do this. But one of the things that I find unusual is that people move in and out really rapidly. The ward that I look at, 1,000 people move in and out during a year. And you don't get to choose which ward you go to. You're assigned a ward. So I think the fact that they worship in these small wards that they're kind of thrown into, but they still find ways to love each other, is really incredible. So I found that this intellectualization of the ward family is how all of this comes together. It doesn't always work for everyone, though. One of the things that happens, Lawrence Iannacone, a sociologist, has done some work in this. And he says that when people leave a group, the group that remains actually becomes a little bit more cohesive. First of all, dissenters have left. The people that are remaining have a little bit more, they have a shared ideas. It's always a little bit easier to relate to someone that you have the same ideas with. The people who leave, if they just can't reconcile things, then they're usually happier, and the people who stay stay, whether they stay because they believe or whether they feel like they have to. And this morning in one of the sessions we talked about Mormons born Mormons and the rates that they either stay or leave. So there's lots of different reasons people do that. But this idea that people who leave actually reinforce the congregation that stays, I think is important. One of the things in contextualizing this idea of ward family, one of the most important, maybe, might be the right word, statements that I got was from a non-member. She was doing a blog for a class at Claremont, and she talked about spending Sunday morning in the Mormon family. And I asked her, what do you mean by that? Why did you use that particular phrase? And she says, I characterize the congregation, the Mormon family, because of the relationships I observed between members, which appeared to be beyond the mere affection of friendship, beyond the fact that everyone addresses each other as brother and sister. The congregation felt close-knit and comfortable with each other. I understand that each ward is unique, just as every Mormon is an individual. But in this ward, on this Sunday, I experienced the ideal of ward family. So I thought if an outsider can feel this on her very first visit to a Mormon ward, I think that there might be something there. So even though those elements that are divisive, some people can reconcile, some leave, but I think that those that stay find that really there is the people that you can, the congregation are the people that take you in when you have to go there. They're the people that are there for you to help you out. And one single middle-aged forced man said that we're all brothers and sisters. We're all there. We love each other with a genuine love for each other in the ward. They're there for me, and I'm there for them too. It's very accepting. It's a home.
Great job. Great paper. Gives us a lot to talk about. I'm going to talk for about 5 minutes about specific aspects of her paper. And then I'm going to take 5 minutes and do a respectful critique with alternatives, theory and literature views from my field, which is anthropology. So to begin with, I think, can I call you Chris?
Oh, absolutely, please.
Yeah, Chris did a great job of describing family and how it's changed over time. She specifically did a good job of describing the rigidity or the narrow margins by which Mormon families exist, in the sense that we talk about family all of the time, but when we talk about family, it's often in the social instance of family, that's the words she used, rather than as the individual family. She used this in the term of saying, when we're saying Prop 8 is threatening our family or attacking the family, they're not talking about individual families, they're talking about the institution of family in and of itself. And that institution within the Mormon Church is particularly rigid. It's a post-World War II version of a family. It's heteronormative, that has a wife that stays at home, a father that provides very masculine and feminine gender roles. I mean, it's a very rigid, narrow margins by which something is considered a family. And I think that's really, really critical to this particular paper and to Mormonism in general. A lot of that has to do with, the generation at which a lot of our leaders were growing up and what was ideal in that time period. Maybe that will change, I don't know. But I think this needs to be emphasized even more in your paper. Do we see this rigidity of family in the ward? Do we see this rigidity of family in the greater society? That rigidity is so idiosyncratic, particularly with Mormonism, that I think we need to needs to be emphasized even more. Second thing that I think that is critical to this paper is this idea that this is an American-centric paper, that internationally we're seeing different forms of family. Internationally we're seeing different types of family. My biggest thing in West Africa, where I do my research, after someone watched the conference where they raised the bar and we made 3 new temples and there was all these new revelations, people said, I just can't believe how much they talk about loving their wives. I mean, wow, that was the shock. Because in where I do my research, marriage is an economic and tribal liaison. It's not a love relationship. It's not a supportive relationship. It's not a coddling relationship. It's more of an economic liaison. So to them, they're like, wow, this church talks a lot about, loving, as part of a marriage. You know, interesting, which, you know, you wouldn't find that in American-centric. Similarly, we had a whole lesson on our children of God, because some children are born by fetish priests or witch doctors, and the church says we don't believe in any of that. That's not the power of God. So then by whom is those children born? Are they devil children? We would never have this conversation in American church, right? We would never look at the family that some of your children may or may not be children of God. So a lot of these issues are quite American-centric, and I think that's important. I think you made a funny joke about the real threat of eternal families. And I think that, you know, is there, and it's really important. But I also think that we have to take that really seriously, in so much that you are not allowed into the temple to secure those family units if you don't pay your tithe, if you don't wear your garments. There are real consequences to not being a family. And I think this is a critical contradiction in your paper that we really have to break through, this idea that families are eternal, family is the center, but I will keep you from them if you don't do X, Y, and Z. Right? That is a critical contradiction in the concept of families with Mormonism, that you have to behave in specific praxic ways in order to be together forever. It's not a given. Although we talk about it at a given from primary on up. But when we get to the temple, no. Mm-hmm. You can't. That's critically damaging in so many areas, and we really, really need to talk about that. It's coercive in a sense, and that just needs to be addressed. Two more things about your paper that I think are fascinating and important. One of them is this idea of rituals of adulthood and of full personhood, that Mormons do have something that hardly any institutions in America today have, which are specific rituals of adulthood. In anthropology, those are things that allow you to let go of the old self, regain a new self, adopt a new privilege, and yet take on a new responsibility. That ritual allows, you know, young men standard and specific instances where they need to become adults, where they need to start providing for a family, where they need to go out on their own and learn how to cook and clean, and right with the mission. That's young women's 12, 14, 16, specific things. Now you can date. Now you can go to state dances. Now, we don't think that that's important, but around American culture, those rituals of adulthood are critical. Hardly any religions, hardly any social groups have these. And what that does, if without these rituals of adulthood, what it leads to is the rapid growth of female maturity, meaning 12-year-olds who are hypersexualized, and the radical retardation of male adulthood. Adult males still playing video games, not getting jobs, not wanting to grow up, right? So we see this in American culture at large, that there's no standard rituals of adulthood. We have that in the church. And that's a very familial-based thing, and it's super important. But there is a negative aspect to that, which she talked about a little bit right at the end, which is if you don't fulfill those specific rituals of adulthood, then you get lost. You're not a full person. So if you don't ever get married, in our church, you're childlike. You're not a full person. You can never gain that full personhood. Women, after you get married, there's really no rituals for you after marriage. You're done, right? So that's damaging. If you don't fit the model that's standard, you know, it can be damaging. So there's some really good and some really bad with that idea of these rituals of adulthood, which is quite centered in the family. The last thing I want to say is when you talked about filial piety or ancestoring our work, ancestor worship. He had a quote on page 8 that was really good about that. Where is it? Okay, Mormons, however, may be the only group for which the duty to care for kinfolk goes beyond the idea of home and caring for kin, to include generations upon generations of ancestors. Within this model, this is a point where the component of family shares a connecting point with the LDS Church piece of the puzzle. Temple ritual anchors family units in church doctrine and enables Mormon to care for their ancestors by performing Celtic temple ordinances. The process of performing these ordinances reinforces the importance of blood family connections and that such connections exist beyond the temporal state. And I felt like that was a brilliant point and something that's quite rare in modern American religions, this filial piety, which you would see in international religions across the planet. Okay, I'm just going to take a few minutes to do a little critique. My big critique is, and I'll raise the question to you guys, and we'll open it up in a minute. Is care the central component? And I think in many instances, the answer for me was, I don't know. And let's go over it a little bit. It's kind of my advisors always say, if you find a contradiction, go with it. That's where your story is. And for me, I see a big contradiction in your paper in this idea of the family unit, the ward family, the social structure, and this idea of care, because there's major contradictions in the LDS concept of family and the concept of care. Okay? And here's where some of those contradictions come in. Okay, so we have care on page 9 of your paper, where it's a beautiful idea of care, this ethics of care, where we learn how to care for one another. We get callings and we volunteer and we serve one another, and that's how we learn how to care. That people learn love through service, like they do through service of their families. And here's where I see the contradiction, though. The church also has a rich, rich, rich history of valuing conformity, cohesiveness, and loyalty over family. In the sense that your son is gay, and back in the day, well, you're not welcome in my home. You're not welcome to bring your partner in my home. I can't support you in that. You won't go to the celestial kingdom if you don't live by certain principles. We actually have quotes by Maxwell, Nielsen, and Elder Oaks, where they said, we don't believe in unconditional love and unconditional care in our religion. We believe in that, you know, that people have to live certain ways in order to make it such a kingdom, in order to be an eternal family. So we have a very conditional-based care, form of care or family in our religion. In fact, we have a big phenomenon of someone leaving the church or having a faith crisis. One of the first things that the traditional partner thinks is, oh, well, we better get divorced. I better marry someone that can fulfill those rights and responsibilities for those ordinances, right? So at what is the core of those relationships? Is it the church or is it care? In a lot of those instances, it's not the family. If the family and care was the pinnacle, central zenith of Mormonism, then your child would always be welcome in your home. Then a divorce would not be precipitated by, you know, a faith crisis. The family and the care would be the thing that strengthens everyone. And the religious conformity or loyalty or obligation or obedience would be secondary, right? So I think that that's quite a interesting contradiction. Similarly, I think I would ask ourselves, in what ways do LDS, doctrine, families, ward families, society, in what real ways do we see care? In what real ways do we see the central focus being on care? And I would beg to argue, well, think about it. Let's think about motherhood. Central focus of women's lives, motherhood, motherhood, motherhood. In what real ways does the church care about motherhood? We do not offer breastfeeding classes, motherhood prep, fatherhood prep. We do not in any real ways, you know, fight for women's social security rights if they're mothers. We don't fight for equal rights amendment that gives women rights in a divorce in case for money. You know, in real ways, we don't really offer support for that care. In fact, what I found fascinating about this care basis is theologically and doctrinally, we do have a basis of care. You are absolutely right. The Bible, the Book of Mormon, Mosiah, our welfare, the law of consecration, D&C, I could keep going. We have this deeply rooted sense of care in Mormon dogma and doctrine. But in praxis, in the reality, let's think about it, highest rates of Republicans and libertarians of most religions. Highest rates of a capitalist-based structure. There's been articles, secular articles published about how the church structure is capital-based, business management run, and quite a money-making institution. We have a pick-yourself-up-by-the-bootstrap mentality. We have a low trust of social programs in our religion. We have, think about the percentage, even though I love our humanitarian aid, I don't want anything against it, but the percentage of money in this church that goes to humanitarian aid versus the percentage that went to City Creek Mall and the percentage that went to, you know, Prop Bay. I could keep going. What I'm saying is if care is central, we would see very real indicators of that financially and in social programs, and we don't. What we see, and here's my second critique, and maybe this will get us really talking here, and it's the last thing I'll say. What we tend to see, however, are enormously fascinating, costly signals of commitment. So if I were to write this paper, the center thing would be commitment, coherence, loyalty. That would be my center. Because in my field, let me explain what a costly signal. A costly signal is something that is hard to fake and very costly to do. So So, for example, wearing garments, hard to fake, and very costly, especially when it's hot, especially if you're a woman, especially over a long period of time, right? Paying tithing, hard to fake and enormously costly. Having a calling for the last 30 years, hard to fake and enormously time-consuming, financially consuming, huge investments. Papers by, and I'll give you these names, Richard Sosis, Candace Alcorda, have written in the Evolutionary Psychology of Religion. It's a wonderful field. And they've written on what religions have the highest rates of commitment and why. Why do some religions die out and some not? Now, the thought process was, well, those religions that don't demand a lot, that are non-denominational, that just love and are built on care, those should last the longest because the people have to do the least and it's the nicest and they get the best out of it. Guess what? Totally wrong. The religions that last the longest are those that have the highest level of sacrifice and commitment demanded of its members. Okay? So for me, this is inherent to the Mormon theology. And why that is because a costly signal of commitment shows everyone else in the room, I'm committed and I'll be there and I'll continue doing this. And so you want to be committed and be there and continue doing this either. And this gets us back to the care focus we had. Because it's so costly. If I don't do it, I lose my family. If I don't do it, I lose my child for eternity, my husband for eternity. I could get kicked out of my home. My parents won't talk to me again. I mean, those are enormously costly signals of commitment. Let me just say a couple more things about that, but I think that's kind of all I wanted to say, that I kind of see, another Sosis and Alcorda article is called Religious Badges and Honors. What badges do we wear that show everyone in our community, I'm committed? Mormons have hundreds of them, right? Hundreds of them to show, look, I'm a good Mormon. We also have hundreds to say, look, I'm a bad Mormon, right? Or I'm not Mormon, or whatever, right? I wear a tank top up here, and I'm being judged differently than I'm wearing it. A jacket, right? So all of these things are how we signal our commitment to the group that sustains us. And I think family is one of those things. I'm signaling my commitment to this religion when I get married in the temple, when I'm, when I don't have sex before marriage, when I don't drink, when I don't have tattoos, when I don't have multiple earrings. Every one of these is a costly signal of the commitment to that group. And that in turn, like you said earlier, makes the group stronger because we're all making these commitments toward one another. And when someone chooses not to make those commitments or leave or isn't as faithful or shows me signs that they're not as committed, that does make the group weaker. Wait, we can go to church in pants? I didn't know that. I want to do that, right? So then it kind of opens up the vein of what's acceptable at church and it makes us a little bit more open, right? Which makes us not as strong, not as committed. So in a sense, it's an argument. So for me, I really, really, really enjoyed your paper. There's lots of quotes I actually had here that I was going to read, but let's give some time for opening up to comments. I think for me, what it came down to is, let's really debate this idea, is at the central focus, is it for Mormons, is it care or is it coherence, conformity, loyalty to the group? And in what measurable ways do we see that?
Thank you.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes for Q&A.
So, and please come up so we can record your question. And
this is
do your main prayer.
Several years ago, I remember hearing that when the church started really putting a lot of emphasis on family, they did it because they had done a research survey in which they found out that people really don't care very much about the church being the only true church, but they really do care about it being a great church for your family. I wonder if either of you have encountered that or given it any thought.
But I'm definitely going to look it up now.
Okay, I'm not sure where to look it up, but I remember that it was discussed a long time ago, like 20 years or, probably longer than that ago, at Sunstone sessions that I was at. Sonia, do you have one? No. Sonia knows.
I'll talk to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have a question. Okay. My impression, sort of, from everything you said is, especially from your comments, it's the family's more than just, it's more in Mormonism. And I was also wondering if you, in your research, have maybe seen examples of the family being a place where priests have power and the priesthood is cradled, and how that reflects obedience to the church at large.
Can you hear me okay?
No.
Okay, yeah, that's... So that's one of the issues that I think when I said that I was hearing marriage advice, how to be a good husband, how to be a good wife, that was, priesthood was a big part of that, how to be a good parent. I heard a lot of people say that that was important to them, but when the single women talked about it, it was an entirely different conversation. So I think you really have to kind of think about the person's personal context, because I really can't say across the board it's one way or another. I think priesthood still is an important part, but I really don't see that that's the main thing that's driving them. Mm-hmm. And I think Chelsea has an excellent point with that conformity is really the key. Mm-hmm. And priesthood is part of that conformity, definitely. Yeah, priesthood as itself, maybe not so much.
Okay. Make sure I say her name right.
Christine. Yeah, Christine. Chris is fine.
Yeah. Your data set, the wards that you looked at, where were they geographically?
Oh, good question. So the wards that I looked at were in New Jersey and Utah and Australia.
Were there differences? I've been an observant, although not maybe devout all the time, but an observant Mormon my entire life, and I've lived in a lot of different states. I don't have any. And the texture of the day-to-day or maybe week-to-week interactions with other board members is very different, mm-hmm. when they're literally your neighbor,
right.
or when they live in a different congressional district. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes a different state.
Or socioeconomic.
Yeah, and well, what I saw in my parents' ward, the ward I was a teenager in Utah, is that the socioeconomic status was pretty stable. But in the ward I live in Pennsylvania right now, we have everything because it's Columbia County. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious if you saw a difference in the sort of reaction, because I mean that would be fascinating if there wasn't a difference. Because it would be more ideological, and it would be fascinating if there was a difference.
Either way, it's fun stuff. My findings have been surprising to me, that I found that when there's more diversity, there's actually more cohesiveness.
Okay, so a ward in a place like New Jersey is a little bit more cohesive.
Actually,
than a ward,
yeah.
Where you would have that.
Yeah, because I think they have to try harder. To find a way to relate to each other. They don't just make assumptions. At least that's my impression. That's kind of what I've seen, is that they put a little bit more effort into getting to know someone, because they are not your next door neighbor. Maybe they do something entirely different, and they have a totally different...
It's one of those costly things
yeah.
that you're talking about, where
right.
they're actually showing up to ward activity means I just spent $15 on gas, mm-hmm. Versus...
Right, right. So it's that level of commitment that is up there that I think, that I've seen. But I haven't spent enough time looking at the demographics, and being an outsider, I don't have access to a lot of the ward records. So I really don't know how much of it is geographic, how much of it is levels of how long they've been a convert.
Cultural. I mean, New Jersey is a very different place.
Absolutely.
From Utah.
I'm still kind of adjusting. Okay.
Our time is up, but thank you all for coming, and feel free to come up with more questions.